Good morning, I'm Dan and I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
I slept great, thank you. It's a nice room. Some nice rooms here. So. Okay. So, there we are. 15:30. Okay. So, in between step one and step two, there's like this hallway. Right? Behind me, I need to be clear on certain things. Because in order for me to come to believe that I need a power greater than myself to restore me to sanity, I have to understand what my insanity is and what I can't do anything about. So the book is interesting the way it lays out. It first talks about the physical craving out here, right? And then the mental obsessions in my mind, right, that take me to that first drink. And then we talked about the second half of step one, the unmanageability of my life, which I also think it's the same for me as the unmanageability of my spiritual life, right? The unmanageability of my spiritual condition. And I talked about something that I don't usually hear a lot of people talk about. A lot of people talk about the problem centers in my mind. But if it was just about a problem in my mind, then maybe a good therapist could take care of it, or the right drugs could knock that edge off. And, you know, but plenty of people, even on medication, will still drink. Right? You know, so I have to understand why this is a spiritual, how this is a spiritual problem, and why I need a spiritual solution. And it was interesting how this came to me, because I was so used to going through from the beginning of the book all the way through the first, those three sides. I was actually sitting in a restaurant. A friend had called and said she was having trouble with balking in the fourth step. So she asked if I would sit with her and see if I can get her motivated. And the best way to motivate somebody is by looking at why is it important that I finish this thing. So we started talking about her drinking. And the conversation wasn't clicking for me. And so it occurred to me that I should start backwards. And we talked about the stuff on page 52. And much like we did last night, but I backed into it. And we talked about... I asked her about her personal relationships. If she was in a relationship that got so bad, that she got so emotionally bothered by it, could she eventually drink? Right. See, my answer would be, I know that if I sit in a bad relation long enough, right, I can get enough discomfort in my life to want to find some escape without a spiritual program, without God. I'm talking about without any of the things that you might have today, just alone, on your own power, could you drink again over a relationship? She said no. So I said, oh, okay, well, maybe she's not that sensitive. This is what about your emotional nature? Emotional nature being the part of my emotions that are inside, not necessarily what you see, right? Because I show you the face that I want you to see, but inside, my emotions might be saying something different. I said, if you were emotionally tortured for long enough and hard enough, do you think you could drink? Do you think that would take you to a drink? Because I'm thinking to myself, yeah, I certainly could use a drink after a good emotional torture, right? She said, no. We went through all these questions, and she wouldn't drink over any of them. And I thought, well, this is interesting. So then, whenever I get cornered with not having a clue what to do when I'm working with someone, I put it back on them. Just spin it around. Say, okay, let's start over. If you sat in a relationship that was really difficult and you weren't getting out of it, what do you think that the obsessions, what obsessions would you experience? What would sitting in that still early for me. I'm actually quite nocturnal. If you sat in a bad relationship long enough, there would be obsessions that would come to you that would feel like the natural thing for you to go to. Right? What would those be? And she said, I'd curl up in my bed with food, and I'd eat myself to death. And I thought, that's interesting. And I said, well, what about the... I went through the rest of the questions. What about your emotional nature? If you sat in a bad place emotionally, where would that take you? She said, same thing. We went through all of these questions on page 52, and it occurred to me how great this is laid out, because, you know, not everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous had a problem with alcohol. Some did, I mean, especially some overeaters, because of a lot of overeaters apparently get triggered by alcohol too, because of the carbs and the sugar in it or whatever reason. I don't know, I'm not familiar with that program that well. But I realized the same thing happened with addicts. You go down this list and it's like, where would these things ultimately take you? If it was a cocaine addict would say, I might drink before I go back to it, but eventually I'd go back to that which I find this illusion of a solution. Right? I have to find out what's true for me. And it's not just so that I can fit into AA. Right? I have to find out what's true for me, because this is what's going to drive me to God. What is it that I need an act of God to save me from? Because if I get clear on why I need a spiritual program and what it is exactly that's going to kill me, right, then I'm going to be much more clear on what my insanity is, right, and my desperate need for more power in step two. Because if I have a problem other than what I'm focusing on, and I go into step two looking for needing a power to restore me to sanity, right? And if I'm not clear on what that is, I'm going to step two just with this vague, in this vague place, and not necessarily needing a lot of power, right? But if I'm clear on what it is that's killing me, right, I go to step two with the urgency of this being about life and death. Right? You know, and that's why it's so important to see what's true for me. And some people go off the wrong direction with this. I think when you start asking questions at the beginning, like, well, maybe you're not an alcoholic, or maybe you don't even need this program, right? And it can sound sometimes like some people are trying to weed Alcoholics Anonymous of all these non-alcoholics, and I don't think, and I don't want that to be misunderstood. That's not my take on it, you know. Because I, as a real alcoholic, don't really want to be in this club. I would rather just be able to go drink without consequences. I would rather you say I don't belong here, because then I can go get a drink. the purpose of that is to drive a real alcoholic to the point where he really can't doubt that he needs this thing, right? The sad thing is that statistics are quite low as far as who actually stays, and I think that this is possibly an important piece of that puzzle, because if I don't see the depth of my problem, then I'm not going to see as much value in the solution. If I see the depth of my problem and it takes me to a place of desperation, then I'm going to step two out of desperation, right? Not just because I like this idea of having this God in my life. Right. So and that's basically what we talked about yesterday. Right. Understanding what are the manifestations of my physical powerlessness, right? The mental state that takes me back to that over and over again, obsessions, right? And the unmanageability of my spiritual condition, the second half of step one, that sets up the condition conducive for that obsession to return, or those obsessions to return. Right? And I believe that becomes real important too, not just in the beginning, but also throughout a spiritual way of life, because it's a way for me to check what my condition is, right? And we'll come back to this later on in 10 and 11, actually. Well, we'll look at this again from a different perspective. So, was there any questions on that first step? We got just a couple minutes before I can. No questions? I had one. Oh, sorry.
When the lady said that it was food that she would go to, then what did she do?
Or discussion.
Carry on.
This discussion after that was, she actually started in a food program, but they told her that AA is where the good program, where the better sobriety was, so she switched. And although she had a lot of friends in AA, so she ended up going to both programs again.
Thank you.
Sure. Somebody asked me about, brought up the question, it was Matt brought up the question of choice before the meeting today. And that's something you hear a lot of, and I think it fits here. And that was part of what we read, that paragraph on choice. And how people will say, and I talked a little bit about it, today I have a choice whether I'm going to drink or not. Right? And I think it kind of, the book specifically talks about we've lost the power of choice. But I know that from a place of especially long-term sobriety, you can feel like you have a choice, because the argument is, yeah, I could choose to drink today. You know, and I hear that all the time, and it's like, yeah, it's like my typical response is, I get that, I understand what you're saying. It's like your choice that you could throw yourself in front of a bus today. Could you choose to do that? And I say, of course, I could choose to throw myself in front of a bus. And I says, well, would you show me? And I says, you can't, can you? He says, because it's really never been about choice. It's been about sanity. Because from an insane place, I chose to not drink, and I absolutely couldn't. Right? But being brought to a place of sanity and experiencing times when I felt like a drink would really help this, and I couldn't drink even if I wanted to. Right? So it's never really been about choice. It's never really mattered what my mind was saying to me. It matters what my spiritual condition is, right? because if I've been restored to sanity, it doesn't matter what I'm thinking, I'm not going to drink. Because I wouldn't do an insane act from a sane place. Right? So I don't get hung up on the word choice, right? Because really, it's about what's sane here. Right? So, all right. So,
what are your thoughts around we conceded to our integral self that we were alcoholics?
Where's, yeah.
At what point is that just...
Right. At what point do we concede to our innermost self that we're alcoholic? Right. I think the first thing to get straight here is, where's your innermost self? Right. It's not here, as he points to his head. Right. My innermost self is not between my ears. Right. My innermost self is here in my gut, where I just know. And I think that that comes at different points for different people. But it also, I think, I think that it's something that's easily forgotten. Right? And that's part of our problem, you know. But we will read books, we'll read the big book, we'll listen to speaker tapes, we'll do all this stuff, right? And hear the right words, right? But nothing will take me to the truth that's in my innermost self more than going through this book and attaching my own experience to it. Because if I see that I drank like Bill, that I think like Bill, that I felt like Bill, if I could relate to the doctor's opinion, if I can relate to all this stuff, right? Right, which is, again, why it's important to look at the physical part, not just from the fact that I lose control once I started, but seeing the consequences as a result of losing control, because I cannot doubt the consequences that came to me from that lack of control, right? Because those are things that I can't dispute. Right, because when you look at the fact that when I started to drink, I lose control, what comes to my mind is all those times that I didn't. Right? Right? Because there were times that because of situations that kept me from drinking. And so there's that element of doubt. Right? But I look at all of the trash businesses that I've started and all of the relationships that died, and all of the times that I made alcohol more important than any of that. And I see that if I just never drank, none of those problems, most of those problems wouldn't have been there, right? I have to see the trail of destruction behind me that I cannot doubt, right? And admit to my innermost self that what alcohol does something different to me than it does to some other people. And I can't doubt that because of my experience. So, thanks. So, we'll start with step two now. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I use we agnostics as a tool to go through step two. Now notice it doesn't say we believers.
No.
Right? It's going to talk about God here. But, you know, we're not even at the third step here where we're making a decision to get this power. So too much talk about my great belief in God here is I don't believe is as effective as looking at where I don't believe, right? And people come to this in different ways. You know, I came to this pretty much an atheist. You know, I trashed my life, and it was like obviously there wasn't a God that cared about what was happening with me, and I have my own past to look at, that, you know, the influences that I grew up with. I grew up in a family with a lot of physical fighting between my parents, and I remember being I must have been 6 years old. I remember, you know, I lived in England, and there was churches all around the school, and they would march us to these churches, from school to the churches, and especially during the holidays, and make us sing hymns and say prayers. And you know, I didn't really understand a lot of it because I didn't grow up in a religious home. But my parents used to fight really bad, and it used to really hurt me. And I remember laying in bed trying this prayer thing and asking God to stop them from fighting, right, to keep them together. Right? God didn't listen to me. Right? Thank God they probably would have killed themselves if they stayed together, they killed each other. You know? Yeah. So, all through life, I lived my life based on the idea that if there was anything that there was to have in this world, it was going to be based on what I do to get it. That I wasn't going to wait for it to just be handed to me. Like, I'm not going to pray for things, because that's, you know, get out and work, right? That was what I believed. If you want something, go out and take it. And which caused its own set of problems, but and I was able to start a lot of businesses, and the idea that I had power in my life was strong. I felt I had a lot of capacity to, and I was sure I was going to retire at the age of 30. What I failed to see was yes, I was able to start a lot of businesses, but I wasn't able to keep them going because of the way I was living. And the other thing was I really wasn't that hireable because I was drinking and using so much. So I had to start businesses to survive. And looking back, I was sort of it just was perfect the way it was working out. But I think I might have hit a wall sooner if I had a job, or if I had regular jobs that I kept getting fired from. But that wasn't the case. So. Still, I was on this mission to be someone, to make myself something, and it just never happened because, again, as I mentioned before, I found myself in 1987 sitting on a couch looking around my life going, what happened? What happened to the dreams and the aspirations that I had? What happened to this great drive that I thought I had to succeed? And, you know, it just never materialized, you know, so I came to this thing not believing that there was a God. But that's not everybody's story. There's plenty of people that I've come across that could recite the Bible to me, that knew exactly what God looked like and how you're supposed to pray just knew way more about religion than I did, way more about God. But you know where both ends come together, where the believer and the non-believer can agree, is we suffer agnostic behavior, even with a belief system of what God is. So I go through we agnostics underlining everywhere where I see that I did not rely on that power. On a power other than my own. And any believer can go through this and underline just as much as a non-believer. Right? Because if I relied on that power that I had this big belief in, then I may not have been here. Right? So, I had all these ideas why this couldn't work, and but the fact is that whatever power I was operating from, you know, look what a great job I've done here. I've got here. Right? On 45, it says, lack of power, that was our dilemma. Now, dilemma is a great word. Dilemma just doesn't mean problem. Lack of power just isn't my problem. Lack of power is my dilemma. And a dilemma is, when I looked it up in the dictionary, I have this great dictionary. It's old and it's 6 inches thick, and it comes up with things there that just blow my mind, because the wording in the dictionary, I don't know. Anyway, it's a dilemma. It's faced with alternatives that I don't like or want. Faced with alternatives that I don't like or want. And the word alternatives jumped out at me and says, oh, it talks about two alternatives on the page before. It says, doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. Right? Doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis. And only an alcoholic would have to think about that question, right? Right? Alcoholic death, spiritual basis of life. Which one do I want? Right? Just another thing that kind of pushes me forward along this process, because I don't want to continue living the way I'm living. Right? But I have no clue how to live on a spiritual basis of life. So how could it possibly work? We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how are we to find this power? And that's exactly what this book is about. So as I said, I go through this chapter, underlining where I don't rely on there being a power other than my own. Setting aside my belief systems, if I have one, right? Or setting aside trying to set aside my prejudices against this, right? Because alcohol hopefully has made me willing to have an open mind. Here. And 47 brings up an important question. It says we need to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there's a power greater than myself? Right. And for people that have done this a few times, there's another way to look at that. Do I now believe, or am I willing to believe, that there's a power greater than myself that can move me beyond where I am today in my process, in my program? The first time I went through this, it was tough because I was still leaning heavily towards atheism. Right. But I knew in my gut, and this comes back to your question about knowing in my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic and what that means. So the desperation of my alcoholic problem, right, was enough to make me willing to at least move forward. Willing to at least have an open mind to what's going to happen. Now, I gotta say this too, is that my home group was an example of people that had more than they were an example of people that had something that I wanted. So I think that my home group was an important factor in the experience here, because seeing more in them, right, made me believe easier that there could also be more for me. You know, which took me to some other thoughts. Like, I wonder if you can get healthier than your home group. And I don't know how to answer that, but exactly. But just a question that came to me. Right. Because it was certainly, there was other groups that I went to that they basically stayed powerless. They talked about things like, I work all the steps in every day in my life, which I don't believe is true. Not least, you couldn't do it the way I do it every day. But we'll get more into that later in 10 and 11. But basically staying powerless, basically staying hopeless, right? Using meetings like unsupervised group therapy.
Right? Oh.
You like that term? Unsupervised group therapy?
Yeah.
Right? As opposed to a spiritual example of this program working on a spiritual basis. Right? So, yeah, I was willing to believe because I saw it in the people around me that they had something more. Right? And I was like, it's like I'm in a burning building and the fire's at the door behind me. And there's firemen down below me saying, jump, we'll catch you. It's like, I don't want to jump. Right? But the thing that's behind me is more scarier. Right? To continue as I am drinking is more scarier than having an open mind about what you're going to tell me in this book. Right? As soon as a man can say that he does believe or is even willing to believe, we emphatically assure him that he is on his way. It has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone of a wonderful effective spiritual structure can be built. Right? A cornerstone is like the first stone in a structure. A lot of times the cornerstone will have the name of the builder or the owner of the building. Right? But it's this first stone in place. Back on page 17, it talks about let me just read it so I don't mess it up. In the bottom of 17, the feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us. But that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. So they're talking about the fellowship. Feeling of having shared in a common peril. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution in this book, in the 12 steps. That we have a way out which we can absolutely agree. And which we can enjoy in brotherly and harmonious action. So they're talking about this powerful cement which binds us, right? And this cornerstone in step two is set on top of that foundation, right? Of the fact that we have a fellowship and a solution, right? And that's the basis of this thing. We put our willingness to believe is that first stone in place because we're going to be building this spiritual structure. And we're going to talk about that more in step three. So, I keep underlining as I go through this paragraph, as I said, where I see that I don't rely on any power other than my own. And it's going to be talking about my prejudices against spiritual terms, right? All the fight I have, the resistance I have against a spiritual way of life, because I had a lot of them. I had this wall of arguments that I would use, not only to you but also to myself, why there couldn't possibly be a God that would work in my life, right? You must be like delusional if you think that there's something that will. Right? But that fight really didn't serve me well, considering where it took me, right? Where my life ended up. So I had to have this open mind, and the question of God was a really difficult one for me. And in meditation, a little exercise came to me, and I'd like to share that with you. But first, I'm going to start at 53 and pose some considerations. When I'm working with someone, and we get to this part of the book, in page 53, where it says, when we became alcoholics, right, when I really knew that I was an alcoholic, crushed by a self-imposed crisis we could not postpone or evade, we had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or else he's nothing. God either is or he isn't. What was your choice to be? All right. So they're talking about either God is everything or God is nothing. Right. God either is or he isn't. Those are they're asking us to make a choice, and this is a really important choice. So what I do is I give the instruction to consider one at a time. What if God is nothing? What if all you people are delusional that are talking about God? What if that little voice in the back of my mind is right when it says, don't believe this stuff? It's a fair question, right? When somebody tells me they never have that question, I usually don't believe them, right? There's the people that are solid believers that will ramble on about God. But if you can underline enough here that if you could underline enough here where you don't rely on God, that means that you're relying more on yourself, so that element of doubt is still there. Your belief is blinding you from it. Because if you really believed, then you wouldn't be underlining anything. Right? So I give them the instructions to sit with, depending on the person. Some people can take it a little more than others. Some people need it longer than others. Some people can't take it long at all. But the idea is, what if there is no God? And sit with that for a week. Stop praying. Stop doing anything spiritual. I already see some people shaking their heads. Right? And it's like, and the response to that is, yes, I know it's scary for some. Right? But first of all, God's not going to punish you for doing any kind of exercise that's going to get you closer to him. Right? Secondly, right? You ignore God all day anyway, most of the time. So what's the difference? Right? Just be honest, and admit it, right? And we'll get into more of that in 10 and 11. But so you usually go through the day ignoring God anyway. Right? Just acknowledge it, live that way, and acknowledge it. Sit with it for a week. Sometimes what I'll do is I'll have them actually do 5 days, because when I work with someone, I meet once a week, same time, same day, every week. I make that commitment to them. And so I give them, I tell them to call me 2 days before we get together, or sooner if they have to, and just sit with the idea of, what if there is no God? And I ask them to stop, as I said, stop doing any prayer, but I ask them to do one meditation. And they could do it more than once if they like. And to go back and use page 52, right? And ask those questions in the middle of 52. Like, what if that little voice in the back of my head is true? That there really is no God. No more power for me than what I can muster up on my own. What would that look like in my personal relationships? If there really was no more for me than what I've ever had without God. Just me on my own power. My love relationships. Right? My family relationships. Work relationships. Friend relationships. Right? What if I had if there was nothing more for me than just me on my own power? What about my emotional natures? What if there really was no God, nothing that would help me or take me beyond that place those emotions that are going on inside of me? Again, I know I keep repeating it, they're not necessarily the emotions you, the face you see, but the emotions that are going on underneath that. What if I had no power to live by that would take me to any better place? What if that little voice in the back of my head that says there is no God, that leaves me in that alone place where it's just me, how would that look like when I'm prey to misery and depression? Alone in my home, just feeling in that swamp of self-pity, right? With no power to get out of that on my own. And feelings of uselessness. Couldn't make a living, completely dissatisfied with my life. What if there is nothing more for me than what I've been operating on my own power? When I consider my dissatisfaction with any life that I've had, feelings of uselessness, the fears, the unhappiness. What if that little voice in the back of my head says there isn't a God that's going to really work in my life? What if I'm right? And we sit with that, and I ask them to review the page 52 at least once a day. To live like there is nothing more for them. Right? And it's not an easy meditation for some. Right? When we first started playing with that meditation, a friend of mine put somebody on it for 3 weeks. It wasn't a good idea. Trust me, I won't go into the specifics. But so just before we get together, I asked them to consider the other question. What if God is everything? What if there is a God? Right? What if that little voice in my mind that's always not believed has always been wrong, and there is a God that could move me beyond all of my problems, right? That can take me further in my life than anything I've ever had? Right? How would that look like in my relationships if I could tap into more power than I've ever known how to use? What would that look like in my emotional natures? Right? If all my fight and arguments and my prejudice against spiritual way of life, what if it was all wrong and I just never learned how to approach it? Right? And I had more power to go into life situations like misery and depression. What if I could identify that and actually tap into something that could get me up out of my house and maybe to a meeting or something? Or just to answer the phone, right? Right? Because it doesn't usually take that much to get out of that place. Right? Because my problems are always spiritual. Right? Either God is everything, or I'm everything. Either God is all there is, or I'm all there is. There's no middle ground here. Right, it has to give me an absolute. Otherwise, I'll take the middle road every time just to not make a decision. Right, but it can't be. Most of us live on our own power most of the time, and I don't know that that's, and I believe that that is actually a God-given ability. Right? But there's more to talk about with that later on. It confuses me because I want to figure situations out. I want to drive through these situations. I want to work on my problems. Right? But I have to see by my past experience where that got me. Right? And it's my past experience that should give me the desperation that I need to lean towards this idea that maybe there's something that I don't know about this. Maybe there's something more for me than I've ever used, right? And all my resistance towards this God thing, maybe maybe it hasn't been necessary. Maybe there is more for me than I've ever had. Right? Am I willing to believe that? Absolutely. Right? Because the alternative, right, that I'm all there is, means that nothing's going to change, that nothing can change for me. So, which leads us into step three, which is made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Now, there's a requirement before making that decision. But before that requirement, I want to touch on this. There's the ABCs that I have to be convinced of. A, that I'm an alcoholic and I cannot manage my own life. And B, that probably no human power could have relieved my alcoholism. And I certainly tried human power to relieve my alcoholism. Therapy, friends, myself. Right? And nothing saved me from that. But the harder one was that God could and would if He were sought. Right? Because I still don't know what God is. I still don't understand how that's going to work. Right? Right? But the truth about my condition keeps pushing me forward anyway. Because I have to believe that there's something more for me. Otherwise, I'm dead. Right? And I don't look at... all the way through up through the sixth step, I don't really talk a lot about God. Even though the book talks about God, but I look at more my agnosticism and my resistance to that. Right? And even in step three, it talks about this being a decision. Right? Just a decision to do what it's going to take to get me to God. But before that, there's this first requirement. First requirement is that we be convinced. And this is on 60 if you're trying to follow along. The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will could hardly be a success. And another great exercise here in step three is to go back through page 52 and look at those questions in regards to self-will. How good is self-will done in regards to my relationships? Right? How well has self-will gotten me to get out of poor emotional conditions, emotional natures, or misery and depression? Right? Any life run on self-will could hardly be a success. I have to be convinced of that. But I think more than anything, again, it's pivotal here because that, not pivotal, but step one is pivotal because I have to be clear on step one why I need step three. Because if I get to step three unable to make this decision, right, towards needing to do the things to get me to this power, the problem is not step three. Right? If I can't make this decision in step three, that maybe the problem's step two, that I never really believed that I needed a power greater than myself to restore me to sanity. But if that's true, then the problem couldn't be step two either. It has to be step one, right? Because maybe I'm not clear that I will drink again. And to drink for me is to die. So look at the time. Okay. On the bottom of page 60, I like to read this part in first person, and I think it's helpful to put it in, to personalize it for me. Dan is like the actor who wants to run the whole show. Dan is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in Dan's way, right? In other words, you know, I want all you lined up like this, right? I had one of the podium in the middle. It was on the side at the beginning. And set everything up just how Dan needed it, right? If Dan's arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as Dan wished, then the show would be great. I like this particular sentence, a couple sentences actually. If Dan's arrangements in his marriage would have only stayed put, if only she would have done, my wife would have done as I wished, then the marriage would have been great. Right? Everybody, including me, especially me, would have been pleased. Life would have been wonderful. If Dan's arrangements at work would have only stayed put, if only those clients would have done as I wished, then work would have been great. We all would have been happy, right? If Dan's arrangements at that meeting would only have stayed put, if only you people would say what I want you to say, then the meeting would be great. Right? We all would be happy if you were just saying what I wanted you to say. Right. We would be pleased if life would. I'm sorry. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. Dan may be quite virtuous. Dan can be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. That's me, right? Right. It's the face I want you to see. On the other hand, Dan can be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. I know it's hard to believe, right? But I do have that side. But as with most humans, Dan is more likely to have varied traits. What usually happens? Dan's show doesn't come off very well. Dan begins to think life doesn't treat him right. Dan decides to exert himself more, right? Exert more of what already hasn't worked, right? More self-will, more playing God. Dan becomes on the next occasion still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. Still, the play doesn't suit Dan. Admitting Dan may be somewhat at fault, Dan is sure that others are more to blame, right? You can relate to that, right? It's your fault my life isn't what it should be. Dan becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. What is Dan's basic trouble? Is there any people pleasers here? Right? Afraid to raise your hand, huh? Listen to what the book says. Isn't Dan really a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? I don't please anybody unless there's something in it for me. Right? Because even people that think they're people pleasers are usually doing it because they want to manipulate a response from you. Right? Because if you don't give them the response they need, they just get pissed off. So much for people-pleasing, right? Isn't Dan not a victim of the delusion that if he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world, if he only manages well? Now, rest is an interesting word. You see rest in other words, like wrestling, right? It's force. Right? So I like to read it like that. Is not Dan a victim of the delusion that he can wrestle satisfaction and happiness out of this world if I only manage well? Right? I work really hard to try to get the things that I need out of the people around me and the things around me. Right? It is not evident to all the rest of the players that these are the things that Dan wants. And do not Dan's actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Right? Too many directors here, I think. Too many people trying to run the show. Right? It doesn't work well when I'm trying to snatch what I need out of the world and you're, from you, and you're trying to snatch what you need out of the world from me. Right? Is it not evident, even in his best moments? I'm sorry. Is he not, even in his best moments, a producer of confusion rather than harmony? Right. So here it's saying I'm a producer of confusion. So I'm the actor trying to be the director. It's also trying to be the producer. Right? Or actor is self-centered, egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. Now, self-centered doesn't necessarily mean I think too well of myself. And it certainly doesn't mean I think too little of myself. What self-centered means to me is that all I think about is myself and what's in it for me. But from an agnostic perspective, right, how else am I going to get what I need? Right? I have to create and pull out of the world what I feel I need to be okay. Because I can't sit back and let nothing happen, because if I don't believe that there's a power that'll work in my life, then I have to be that power. Skip to page 62. Selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our trouble. Okay. That's just the first sentence of the paragraph. Right? But people hang on that. And if I say, what's your trouble? Oh, selfishness and self-centeredness. Right? Because that's what the book says. But it says that it's driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And those are the things that we're going to look at in the fourth step, specifically in the fourth column of the fourth step. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation. But we invariably find that sometime in the past, we've made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. What I have to see is, yes, it says that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my trouble. But if I had a plant and I pulled it out with roots and all and I set it on the table, right, it would die. Right, it could not live. Right, it has to be in fertile soil. And what the experience of the fourth step has to take me to is that agnosticism is the fertile soil that the roots of my trouble, my roots of my selfish, self-centered actions and attitudes thrive in that agnosticism. Right? That agnosticism is the fertile soil that my selfish, self-centered root of my trouble thrives in. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves. And the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot. So that should give us hope that my troubles are basically of my own making. Right? Because if it really was all your guys' fault, the condition of my life, then you'd all have to change for me to be okay. Right, but if my troubles are basically all of my own making, right, then something just has to change in me. Right, and that's what we're hoping for here. Right. So that last paragraph on 62, the third step prayer is not the third step. It's an affirmation of the third step. You ever hear someone get up to the podium and say, I don't know how this program works or why it works? I don't know if they do that here, but I've heard it at home. Well, direct them to this paragraph. This is the how and the why of it. This is how it works and why it works. So how does it work? And this paragraph is the third step prayer. And we look at this paragraph, and then I send the people that I work with home to consider some questions in this paragraph. So here's how it works. First of all, we had to quit playing God. That's how it works. I have to quit playing God. Right? And why does that work? Because playing God didn't. Too simple, I know. How it works and why it works is I have to quit playing God, and why it works is because playing God didn't. And so there's some, then it says, next we decided. So here's the decision that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal. We are his agents. He is the father, and we are his children. So there's three relationships there: father, child, principal, agent, actor, director. I turn those into questions, and I ask, and I, as I said, I sent the people I work with home for a week to consider them, right? Because it's going to mention in this, the next page, that we thought well before taking this step. And the first question is that regarding the actor and director, how good a job have I done directing my life up to this point, right? Well, based on what I've seen in the first three steps, it's not very hard to answer, is it? Okay. I've also heard people say they take the third step, they did the third step and they took it back, take the third step and took it back. What part of I didn't direct my life too well do you want to take back? There's really not much to take back there when I look at my experience and acknowledge that I didn't do a very good job because my great direction ended me up at, right here in AA. The next question that I ask them to consider is the principal and agent. The agent has a fiduciary responsibility to be who the principal would have them be. Right? In other words, if I am the principal and you're my agents, and you're supposed to be who I need you to be. So if I'm standing here and I'm the principal, how good a job have I done making you be who I need you to be? How good a job have I done making me who I would have me be? Right. Either you're not listening to me because you're not being who I would have you be, right? Or whatever, I don't know. Bottom line is I can't make the world around me change. I can't make you be who I need you to be, to fix me, to give me what I need. I can't even be who I need me to be. Right? When I look at myself, and I can be most critical of myself more than anybody. Right? I can't make myself who I would have me be, on my own power, by myself, without this program, without God. And then the third question is the father and child relationship. In Freudian psychology, the father is the provider. And that kind of goes along with what it says on the next page. It says, so the father provides what the child needs. So the question here would be, how good a job have I done providing what I need on my own power? Just me on my own power, without God, without this program, just me alone. All right. So I consider that, those three things. How good a job have I done directing my life? How good a job have I done making you be who I would have me be? And how good a job have I done relying on myself, providing what I need on my own power? And then I look at the other side. What would a reliance on God look like to direct my life? What would it look like if I would just be who God would have me be? What about if I trust that God will provide what I need if I turn to Him? I look at both sides and then to make this decision. Right? And it's based on the truth about the way I've lived up to this point, and there's nothing to take back here. Right? So, our time is up, but I think that this is important stuff, and I'll come back and finish this up. This is sort of where I stop when I'm working with people. Anyway, right? So it'll give you something to think about until we get back together. How good a job have you done directing your life? How good a job have you done making others be who you would have them be? And how good a job have you done providing what you need on your own power? Right? The decision to turn to God and to do the things that are going to get me to this understanding of how to access and direct that power, you know, are going to be based on this. Is me stopping playing God. Right? There's only room for one of us. All right, thanks. So we'll come back at 10:30. Thank you.